From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And after circling the planet Saturn almost 300 times, the Cassini spacecraft has sent back its final data. This morning, the craft plunged into Saturn's atmosphere and burned up. Cassini left the Earth 20 years ago and has traveled almost 5 billion miles. During that time, it's been sending back data that have changed scientists' understanding of the mysterious planet and its 60 moons. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca is at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He joins us. Hi, Joe.
Hey there.
And let's listen to the sound here. This is what it sounded like this morning as Cassini was doing its death dive into Saturn.
Call loss of signal at 115546 for the S-band. So that would be the end of the spacecraft.
Project manager on FSO Quart. Maybe a trickle of telemetry left, but just heard the signal from the spacecraft is gone, and within the next 45 seconds, so will be the spacecraft.
They're so sober about that, Joe, but yeah. What was it like there when that happened?
You could see maybe a little tear showing up in a couple people's eye. It was sad. I mean, a lot of these guys have worked on, I think that woman that you heard speaking just now is Julie Webster, and she's been working on the mission since 1997. So you kind of think, whoa, man, that's a long time.
Yeah.
And, I've talked to her. She's sad. She's proud. It's a mixture of emotions. This was a very successful mission.
Well, remind us why it had to end now.
Well, I think my colleague Scott Newman just wrote a great line. He says, a billion miles from Earth and no gas station in sight. It was basically out of gas. And that's not necessarily a problem because the laws of physics would have kept it in orbit for quite a while. But there's also this other problem with the laws of physics that if a moon of Saturn happens to swing by, it will give the spacecraft a little nudge from its gravity, or not a nudge, but let's not argue. And so it's possible that it could be knocked into an orbit that would have it crash into a moon of Saturn. And that would be bad because it is just possible that there is some kind of bacteria or some other microorganism that got stuck to the spacecraft before it left Earth. And if it landed on a planet that could harbor life, wouldn't it be sad if the life that the planet evolved into came from Earth? That would be bad. So NASA wanted to say, let's not run the risk of that happening. We'll just destroy the thing.
So what are some of the big things that we learned from Cassini?
Well, as I was saying, an appreciation of the two moons, Enceladus and Titan, and the potential that they both have for harboring life. Enceladus, the spacecraft detected these plumes of salty water spewing out from the poles, and that was quite a surprise. And then in Titan, there is a liquid ocean below a solid crust, below a methane lake with an atmosphere of methane and a lot of interesting organic chemistry because, you know, methane is an organic molecule. And so we were talking about this is the concept of a prebiotic chemistry. In other words, what were the conditions that allowed life to emerge on Earth? Well, at some point, they were just chemicals and something happened. And so they think the possibility is that the same thing could be going on Titan.
What about Saturn's rings? What did we learn about them?
Well, the rings, there's people who've been obviously obsessed by those.
Well, they're so pretty. I mean, you can't blame anybody for being obsessed with
them. They are gorgeous. And they have a structure in them that wasn't appreciated. Obviously, you can see them as rings from Earth, but even within the rings, the particles come together, they move apart. What's happening there? Why is that happening? Where is the material coming from that's replenishing the rings? There was a lot of questions that Cassini began to provide some answers to.
That's NPR science correspondent Joe Palca in Pasadena at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory as the Cassini mission comes to an end. Joe, thanks so much.
Oh, it's great to talk to you.
Well, for 17 years, different humans have lived and worked in space, and the technology it takes to pull that off is amazing. But human cooperation is fundamental. Reporter Max Green takes us to a time when that social compact was strained.
It's 1973. Three astronauts are about to rocket to nearly 300 miles above the surface of the Earth.
3, 2, 1.
The Skylab 4 astronauts had trained for several years, but mission captain Jerry Carr says the trouble started right then, on takeoff.
A lot of guys had described that ride as like riding on a train with square wheels.
Carr is 84 now and lives in Vermont. He says, sure, they were expecting a bumpy ride, but it was so bad that Bill Pogue, an experienced demonstration pilot whose nickname ironically was Iron Belly, threw up.
We looked at him and said, good Lord, this guy is a former Thunderbird. He could do acrobatics in an airplane that would make the rest of us sick.
At the time, folks at the Johnson Space Center in Houston were all uptight about a new thing called
Space Motion Sickness, or SMS. Space Motion
so
Sickness.
So we decided that we would just not tell anybody about it.
They wanted to downplay the problem because they were worried doctors on the ground would overreact and it would become a whole thing. So they decided they'd conceal the evidence, maybe even throw the sick bag out of an airlock.
And that was a dumb thing to do because we had left our intercom system running.
The jig was up. They got on a conference call, and the big boss in Houston gave them an earful. But things cooled off soon after. They settled in for their 84-day stay aboard Skylab.
Man's first home in space.
The equivalent of a small bungalow out there in space with a beautiful view of Earth.
Life was mostly normal. There was the daily routine of scientific experiments, cleaning, making repairs. Their rigorous schedule was jam-packed from 6 in the morning until about 10 at night.
And that made a pretty long working day out of it.
Eventually, they were so far behind schedule, they were giving up days off to make up for it.
We lasted on that for about 40 days or so. Then we just, we pretty much had it.
Now, what happens next depends on who you ask. Carr, the mission captain, says the crew wasn't paying attention and didn't check in with Houston at a scheduled time. But other takes on the situation suggest the astronauts took an intentional break, kind of like giving themselves a timeout from the stress and what felt like micromanagement.
What has been called by some people as the mutiny.
Either way, there was some unexpected silence for a while. Then both sides acknowledged there was a problem, and about halfway through the mission, they all convened to share their feelings.
That's when we had our what I call a sensitivity session in space.
They went back and forth. Houston didn't understand why deadlines were being missed and why the astronauts were griping about their schedules. The Skylab program cost millions of dollars per day, and the whole world was watching. Up in space, Carr and the others felt like they were being held to an almost impossible standard. They had no time to do basic things.
We had an antagonistic attitude there for some time, and before we got it off our chest, they got it off their chest, and then we went ahead and looked for a way to solve the problems.
So they compromised. Mission control would be more affirming about telling the guys up there when they did a good job. The crew would have more time to work out and take showers, something they almost never got to do. In the end, the Skylab 4 crew got their day off. Carr says he spent some of that time listening to music on his Walkman while enjoying the view of Earth. And what music were you listening to?
There's one funny song that says, when you're hot, when you're not, you're not. It was a popular young Western-style artist, Jerry Reed. When you're hot, you're hot.
When you're not, you're not. The Skylab 4 mission alerted NASA to a kind of problem it hadn't really run into before. Astronauts living in space full-time is very different from short missions in orbit. And to try to get a better picture of what it's like to be up there on the space station for months on end, NASA had astronauts keep a journal. Here are some excerpts.
We are constantly aware that the ground is watching and evaluating.
I have trouble recalling if I called my wife today or yesterday.
Sunday is meant to be a day of rest, but somehow Houston managed to make it feel like Monday.
Those were real journal entries from astronauts on board the International Space Station in the 2000s with help from voice actors. And NASA has used those insights to try to prevent communication breakdowns like the one that happened on Skylab 4. So I called the man whose job it is to better understand astronauts' thoughts and feelings.
Al Holland.
He's a NASA senior psychologist at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Holland says accounting for our basic nature is key for successful missions beyond Earth orbit. And because the next place we want to go,
Mars,
is so far away,
that distant planet,
human training and prep is more important than ever.
It's going to be a radically different way of doing business.
It'll be the longest duration space flight we've done so far, more than a year to get there and back, plus time spent on the surface. And once you're there, you're tens of millions of miles from Earth. Messages will take about 20 minutes round trip. Holland calls this communications delay comm lag.
That's going to lead, I think, to not only more pressure on the crew to be independent and to work independently, but there's going to be no opportunity for, you know, just natural conversation or for real-time video conferencing with your family.
Which can lead to disconnectedness with family and tension and conflict on the job, kind of like what happened in 1973.
There'll be a lot more strain on the understanding between the different camps. Because, you know, when you have less information, you have more room for speculation and misinterpretation, and that is a risk of a we-they dynamic beginning to increase.
Experts are working on some high-tech solutions to reduce comm lag using radios and lasers, but the reality of that delay isn't going away. So Holland says NASA's focusing on training, preparing future space travelers for long-duration stays in isolation, problem-solving, and keeping cool. He says members of the first group to go to Mars may already be among a pool of selected astronauts. And on top of planning for their first steps on the red planet, they'll also be working on their people skills. For Here and Now, I'm Max Green in Chicago.
And Max's story comes to us from The Pulse at WHYY. Conservative Republicans are reeling from President Trump's deal this week with Democratic leaders that will allow so-called Dreamers to stay in the U.S. with more border security but no border wall. And they're making their feelings known on social media. Now, on Friday, we look at the news through social media, so let's do that with Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
So what are people saying?
Oh, let me give you a little flavor of it. At PG Angel says, "Gonna sneak my kids into Disney World, and you better let them stay because it's not their fault I didn't wait in line and pay like everyone else." Mm-hmm. She is not happy with hashtag DACA deal. At Real James Woods, the actor James Woods, mm-hmm. hence the Twitter handle, is very conservative and tweets very conservative thoughts online. And he says about President Trump, if he does not build the wall, he simply will not get reelected. If he does build it, he will win 2020 by a landslide. A little bit of political analysis there by at Real James Woods. The president, meanwhile, is thinking, well, he's thinking this. He tweeted this about 24 hours ago. "Does anybody really want to throw out good, educated and accomplished young people who have jobs, some serving in the military? Really?" Of course, he asked a question and there was an answer immediately underneath that tweet, getting thousands and thousands of retweets from Michael Gray. "Yes, they must go back. When we voted for you, it was to save America, not support illegal immigrants." He goes on with eight pithy tweets, all pushing back at the president's decision at the moment to maybe work out a deal for DACA recipients.
Well, it's just amazing how the president, being such an active Twitter user, has meant he's had this conversation, and often it's his biggest supporters. Ann Coulter said, President Trump should be impeached. Breitbart News has got the hashtag Amnesty Don. People are posting pictures of themselves burning the MAGA Make America Great Again hats.
They are. And at Sean Hannity, who is a personal friend of the president, he tweeted, "I blame Republicans. They caused this. They wanted him to fail and now pushed him into the arms of political suicide. Dot, dot, dot. This is important. Capital letters. If true."
If true about the DACA deal. Okay, well, it seems to be. So we'll continue to watch a reaction to that on social media, which is also reacting to National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster's call for every federal agency to hold a training on leaking. Now, BuzzFeed News discovered this because that call was leaked. So how is this going over online?
People were laughing, basically. And I can quote you bits of the leak program or the anti-leak program. It actually refers to every federal government department and agency. So that is huge. And it's a 1-hour training for unauthorized disclosures. And the reason that comes from the National Security Advisor that it's so important is because it causes harm to our nation and shakes the confidence of the American people. That was not a classified document, but the idea was not that it then circulates around the internet at the same time.
Right. Also this week, people reacted to reports that Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin asked to use a government jet for his honeymoon. Now, we remember he traveled to Kentucky on a government jet to see the eclipse. His wife posted those pictures of all her designer clothing getting off of the jet. Mnuchin apparently withdrew the request for the honeymoon jet, but he is worth $300 million. So what's the commentary there?
Well, the commentary is, I went straight to the Treasury Secretary's Twitter feed just to see what he was thinking. And there were two really important tweets. The first one at the top says, "I didn't use a government plane on my honeymoon. And if I had, I would have paid for it myself. Hashtag fake news." And his honeymoon took in France and it took in Scotland. It was rather glorious. It went all over Europe just earlier on in the summer. Now, what actually happened, as far as we understand, is that he said, "I have a national security issue. Can I take a jet?" And his authorities and officials said, "Actually, we have another way for you to still have secure communications." Just underneath that tweet was an interview that he did with Politico recently, and he explains it in more detail. He put that video up there. So again, on his Twitter feed, at Stephen Mnuchin 1, you can see his explanation for what happened. His explanation and the way that the information spread out is it's fake news. "I didn't use the jet. I wasn't going to. I was looking for a national security way of keeping my communications safe."
Alrighty then. Okay, look, a couple things we just want to mention in passing. People should go look for the picture that actress Selena Gomez posted, an Instagram photo of herself and the actress Francia Raisa, I think, her friend, and now her kidney donor. She had a kidney donated from this friend. Gomez had lupus, and she hasn't shared much. That picture has just gone viral, and it's just lovely. And we just want to talk about the hot dog vendor at the University of California, Berkeley. He went viral when he was busted for not having a permit, and video showed the officers writing him a ticket but taking his cash. Listen.
"That's not right, man.
Oh. That's how it works.
That's not right.
Back up.
Oh, that's not right."
Oh, we just have a couple seconds, but that spawned the hashtag Justice for Juan and a GoFundMe campaign. I mean,
the
this
policeman
is,
wrote him a ticket, took his money, and the internet was so unhappy, they did a crowdfunding roundup for him. And the goal was $10,000. Wait for it, Robin.
How much?
$82,480,000. He's
then
going to buy a food truck.
Femi
with
Okay,
that money.
Host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the extent of the damage caused by Hurricane Irma in the Virgin Islands is still coming into view. St. John, the smallest of the three U.S. Virgin Islands, was battered by the storm, leaving its residents without power and less than 1 week's supply of fresh water, according to the chief of the Army Corps of Engineers. St. Croix fared better, but in St. Thomas, the damage is much worse. NPR's Jason Beaubien is there in St. Thomas. Jason, what are you seeing where you are?
You know, this place was really slammed. It is kind of amazing. You know, you can just see the way the wind hit these what used to be lush green hills and just flattened sort of everything in its path and ripped like every little leaf off trees on some hillsides, just turning them brown. And then the houses in there, you know, many of them ripped to pieces. Other ones, you know, that are solid concrete, some of those completely survived. But even some of those, you know, that are look like very solid buildings, the roof's completely ripped off and big sections of walls sort of tossed around. You know, it was incredibly powerful when this storm hit.
This is an island of about 52,000 residents. Have any of them been able to return to their homes?
The amazing thing is that most people are actually in their homes. There are not enough shelters for all of these people. So people are simply living in their damaged homes for the most part. Some people have moved to shelters. Some other people have been evacuated off the island. But quite frankly, the majority of people here, even though, you know, their roofs might have been ripped off on one part of their house, they're living in another. And that's really the way most people are dealing with this crisis right now.
We spoke the other day with a pastor on the U.S. Virgin Islands who was saying that people had been promised FEMA tarps to cover up the holes on their roofs. Are you starting to see tarps up there yet?
We're starting to see tarps, but only in very limited numbers. And that is definitely something people need. People want more tarps. FEMA says they're bringing them in. You, however, are not yet seeing widespread, you know, tarps covering lots of different places. That's one of the things that's in play at the moment. But yeah, it's still a work in progress.
St. Thomas's airport is tentatively set to open on Saturday, but obviously with limited flights. How difficult has it been to get supplies in?
It's been very difficult to get supplies in. And part of the whole problem is if this had just happened, you know, sort of out of the blue, St. Thomas got hit, all the supplies would be coming out of Florida. And Florida was dealing with Irma itself when you know, St. Thomas was recovering here. So that has been a huge problem in terms of the overall supply lines coming in here. You also had, you know, St. Croix, which didn't get as much damage, but they've been without power ever since. I mean, you know, they're definitely, things are much better. Power's coming back much faster in St. Croix. But, you know, they were also affected. That would be another supply line in. So it's been very difficult in terms of logistics of getting stuff in. The airport, you know, they just got a tower going again so that the flights are being controlled and it's not just visual flight rules coming in there. The port's got debris all over the place, so getting boats in is difficult. Yeah, logistically, getting supplies in here has been one of the biggest challenges.
And what's needed most at this point?
You know, at this point in time, it's just the basics. It's getting the power back up. You know, the streets are getting cleared so people can move around. It's getting food in here. People have been more than a week eating through whatever supplies they've got in their cabinets, you know, their hurricane supplies. Those are starting to diminish. Also, fresh water. You know, people are burning through all the fuel in their generators. So those types of emergency supplies that people had, those are starting to be depleted. That's going to have to get, you know, ramped up. And then construction supplies. People used a lot of stuff to board up ahead of the storm, getting more construction supplies so people can start to rebuild.
Is there any sense at this point, Jason, of how long it's going to take for things to get closer to normal in St. Thomas?
Everybody seems to be saying that this is going to take months. We're not talking about weeks. We're talking about pushing this, you know, into 2018. I mean, talked to some people who are saying, you know what, I'm just going to pack up, leave for the mainland for a while, come back in a few months. That's what some people are saying. You know, even the head of the Ports Authority, he's saying 9 months to get the airport completely up and, you know, operational again, with, you know, commercial flights coming in and completely fixed. It's going to be a very long time to get St. Thomas over the damages from what was, you know, one of the most powerful hurricanes ever recorded in the Atlantic.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien joining us from St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands as they start to clean up from the damage from Irma. Jason, thank you.
You're absolutely welcome.
And by the way, we are keeping an eye on Hurricane Jose in the Atlantic, which could threaten the northeastern United States middle of next week. We'll keep watching.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
It was an awkward moment at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government last night.
I'm very sorry to have to announce that the CIA director will not be speaking here tonight.
That's Dean Douglas Elmendorf breaking the news to an audience that the evening speaker, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, had canceled. He canceled in protest of the school's decision to name Chelsea Manning, a visiting fellow at the school's Institute of Politics. She, of course, is the former military analyst and transgender woman who served 7 years of a 35-year sentence for giving troves of classified government documents to WikiLeaks. Earlier in the day, the former CIA deputy director, Michael Morell, resigned from his own fellowship at Harvard. And early this morning, the school rescinded Manning's invitation, saying it was a mistake. The Boston Globe's Deirdre Fernandez has been following this story. And Deirdre, when the dean, Elmendorf, did rescind this appointment, what did he say?
He said that basically the approach that Harvard took for selecting its fellows, that they didn't follow through on this one with Manning, and they felt like he had made a mistake, and the school had made a mistake in giving Manning this fellowship, and that basically it was considered a type of honor, and they should have thought about that more carefully.
Well, Manning's sentence was commuted by President Obama before Obama left office. So are there any feelings from staffers that somebody whose sentence has been commuted by a president ought to have a place in the school?
Yeah, and I've heard from students, too, who say they feel like there would have been some value in having Manning there and talking about her experiences and picking tough questions from students and faculty about, you know, the whole issue of whistleblowing and whether that's appropriate and when it's appropriate. So I think there are people who are upset now that the school has rescinded the invitation.
Right. But the protests of Pompeo and Morrell are reminders of how the intelligence community still views Manning.
Yes, it does. It is. And I think there was a lot of blowback, especially from conservative voices yesterday. I think Mitt Romney even jumped into the fray saying that Harvard made a mistake and shouldn't have done this. So it's still controversial.
Well, today Chelsea Manning tweeted that she's honored to be the first disinvited trans woman from a visiting Harvard fellowship. What else are we hearing from her?
Yeah, and she also, I think, tweeted that the CIA is now dictating what Harvard should and shouldn't do.
Yeah. Are there also questions about other Harvard fellows? This is at Harvard's Institute of Politics. They included former press secretary Sean Spicer, President Trump's former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski. Controversial in their own right.
Yeah, and there's also been some blowback on the Corey Lewandowski pick too. So there, I've heard from people who've been upset about that, in part because of the way he grabbed a female reporter during the campaign trail. So I think if Harvard wanted to raise some controversy, they've done that.
Yes. The Boston Globe's Deirdre Fernandez, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And here's more of Dean Elmendorf's full statement. He said the school hadn't intended to honor Manning or endorse any of her words or deeds, as we do not honor or endorse any fellow. I see more clearly now that many people view a visiting fellow title as an honorific, so we should weigh that consideration when offering invitations. Your thoughts. Did Harvard do the right thing in rescinding the invitation to Chelsea Manning? Did they cave when a government official canceled? Let us know.
The United Kingdom is dealing with its fifth terrorist attack this year. Police say a homemade bomb detonated on a packed subway train at the Parsons Green station during rush hour this morning in London. More than 20 people were hurt. No one was killed. Joining us now is the BBC's Adina Campbell at Parsons Green. And Adina, it sounds like this could have been far worse. What more do we know about this attack?
Well, Jeremy, this, of course, is an ongoing, extensive investigation. We were actually one of the first broadcasters to arrive here near Parsons Green Underground Station this morning and saw the early response by the emergency services. We saw the cordons going up and the many police vans arriving, along with the armed police guiding people away from the crime scene. We now know that police are treating this as a terrorist incident. They were called just before 8:30 this morning after an improvised explosive device was found in a supermarket carrier bag and then detonated. Some commuters on board the train saw flames and the smoke rising from that bag.
Has there been a claim of responsibility?
Not at the moment. Police have launched a wide manhunt. They have hundreds of detectives working on this case. Where I'm positioned at the moment is opposite the Parsons Green Park, where most of the media have set up their cameras. This is a residential part of London. And today, over the last few hours, we've seen many people coming together near some of the pubs and the cafes in this area, giving each other support, sharing things like tea and coffee. And free food has also been handed out by some of the local businesses here. Officers, as I say, are now looking for the person who placed the device on the train, with hundreds of detectives and MI5 officers investigating. At the moment, officers from the Metropolitan Police, British Transport Police, along with the London Fire Brigade and the London Ambulance Service are here at the scene.
As I mentioned, this is just the latest attack in London this year. Does it look like any of the others, though?
Well, this one is slightly different because this is the first one where no one has died. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, has tweeted and has spoken after what happened this morning, saying that her thoughts are with the injured and she's pleased that the emergency services are responding so bravely to this terrorist incident. And the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, he's appealed for calm, saying that the city will never be intimidated or defeated by terrorism.
That's the BBC's Adina Campbell joining us from London. Adina, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Of course, any attack makes people think immediately of ISIS. A recent BuzzFeed article is titled, "The Good News? ISIS is Failing. The Bad News? ISIS Fighters Want to Go Home." And the reporting finds that home countries aren't that interested in helping former ISIS fighters return. Mitch Prothro is European security correspondent for BuzzFeed. He joins us from Brussels by Skype. Mitch, tell us more about that, this sense that these thousands of fighters that mobilized to go to Iraq and Syria now want to come back.
Well, there are certainly large concerns among the European security community about this return, because over the, you know, from about 2012 to 2013-14, thousands of these people went off either to fight or to, you know, take their families to the new proto-caliphate. And a lot of them have European travel papers or residency or citizenship. And there's a grave concern that they're coming home. And in a lot of cases, as I learned with the French, particularly, and to a certain extent, the Belgians, they'd be really relieved if maybe, you know, this was settled on the battlefield, or they're perfectly happy to let the Iraqis or the Syrians try their citizens for having gone off to fight jihad.
Well, what you're saying is they'd be fine with them being killed in Syria or Iraq as opposed to them coming back and launching attacks.
From a legal standpoint, it certainly would streamline things for them. Because when somebody comes back, you know, in the past, there'd been sort of a dearth of intelligence about the Islamic State. So if you'd been a French fighter and you'd managed to get out and get yourself to Turkey, you were probably pretty well received at that stage. You were probably going to go to jail and on trial, but you were going to be able to also cut a deal to trade what you knew, you know, for a possibility of a life.
Well, you say that the collapse and dispersal of much of ISIS is actually an intelligence boon.
Right. So what's happened now is nobody really needs you. And if they get you and you get, you know, extradited back to France, there's going to be this long trial and all of the stuff. And they're perfectly willing to do that. European countries have regularly tried, you know, people arrested and tried, jailed people for going off to join the Islamic State. But when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people out there in Raqqa and Mosul and now down in Deir ez-Zor, you know, if these guys get settled on the battlefield, I think that that would, you know, at least relieve a certain segment of the European security services, because already what we have found is the security services across Europe are overwhelmed with the number of small scale terror plots, even not including this population.
Well, you quote an Italian law enforcement official saying, and I'll be tender here, it's an effing nightmare to keep track of all these guys who might be dead or might have a new name or might want to come home. These security services who have been trying to keep track of fighters who've gone to Syria, as another professor at King's College London tells you, these agencies are stretched to the breaking point, responding to plot after plot.
There's been such a high, you know, tempo of small attacks, and then also people with jihadist tendencies that were already on the list. I mean, I think the S list in France is notorious for having close to 11,000 people on it. I've talked to people here in Belgium who've said that there's hundreds of people that they're trying to monitor in a very small country. So these are already the people that they're dealing with who didn't go to Syria. The concern is, let's say if thousands went and hundreds managed to return, you know, there's a strong possibility the vast majority of those people are just going to go on to lead normal lives. But what some people have warned me, and, you know, that they're very concerned about, is it doesn't take many, you know, 10, 20 people deciding to become operative with Belgian or French or Italian or whatever passports. That's really going to raise the operational tempo here. And that has people worried.
So there's the fear of these hundreds of fighters coming home from Syria, Iraq, these other areas, because ISIS is being dispersed in those areas. But then on a second track, it seems like you're writing about attacks like the horrendous attack in Barcelona, where this cell was discovered. Some blew themselves up in a house making a bomb. And it doesn't seem to have any tie to any group.
Well, certainly that's what we've seen in the case of, you know, what a lot of people like to call lone wolf, or sort of guided individual people who've been radicalized online or somehow themselves and decided to act alone. Those people are very hard to interdict because, you know, they might not be in contact with anyone. What was chilling about Barcelona, I think, for a lot of professionals in the intelligence world, was the fact that, you know, essentially 12 teenagers kept a secret for almost a year. Mm. and were only discovered when the bomb that they were building went bad. That's very alarming and very unusual. And the fact that that cell hasn't been tied to anybody on a professional international level, be it ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, people are still grasping for a link there because it's amazing that a self-starting cell grew so big and did not draw itself to the attention of the authorities. There's a three-pronged thing that we're looking at right now. There's sort of lone wolf actors, as some people like to call them, or individuals who sort of get radicalized or decide to act and then run out. Usually it's a small scale attack, but it can be huge like we saw in Nice, or pretty big as we saw in Berlin. Then you've got like cells that are operational in Europe. The Brussels Paris cell that did the Bataclan and Brussels bombings, that would be a good example of that. And they were linked to a bunch of other smaller attempts. Then on top of it, we've got this third, you know, what people consider the exodus or returning wave of ISIS guys that will join that population. We don't know how many people will get back, but like, you know, as one guy said, just a few can really cause trouble.
Well, and you quote that King's College London professor saying, "The sad reality is that Europe must prepare for a long and sustained terrorist threat that will persist for at least half a generation."
I think that's accurate. If you look at it, it's been going on about a generation. I mean, there's been various degrees of terrorism linked to political Islam, you know, across Europe since, you know, the early 80s, late 70s, even if you don't count the leftist Palestinian issues. You know, so this has been an ongoing thing. I don't think it necessarily is a debilitating end of the world type scenario for Europe, but I would say it's going to be a kinetic, ongoing law enforcement intelligence problem for years to come.
Until those returning fighters and those lone wolves die out.
And until, you know, people do need to address the roots of radicalization, you know, factors that go into this. And of course, that's a whole other series of articles and segments.
Yeah. Mitch Prothro, European security correspondent for BuzzFeed. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
There's a new musical premiering this month, and in the same way that Mamma Mia used familiar ABBA songs to tell an original story, this musical repurposes old favorites by the late 1970s singer-songwriter Dan Fogelberg. But the premiere isn't in London or New York or even Los Angeles. It's in Nashville. Amy Eskind of member station WPLN tells us why.
Hollywood film producer Kate Atkinson was listening to Dan Fogelberg on a long car drive when it dawned on her that his lyrics and even extended instrumental sections lent themselves perfectly to a stage musical.
I was listening to Netherlands for probably the 10th time. And there's that beautiful orchestral opening. And I said out loud, this is the opening of a Broadway musical.
So she teamed up with soap opera writer Karen Harris, and they conjured up a story about a pregnant teenager who is forced to give her baby up for adoption. The play tracks the estranged mother and son through the 60s and 70s. The central theme is that everything happens for a reason, and the writers feel that the same thing happened to the show itself. Fogelberg's widow, who lives in Maine, said she'd be in Nashville if they wanted to make their pitch for music rights. Neither of the writers had ever been, but after that, they would return many times over the course of 7 years for the show they named Part of the Plan.
And it says you love when you can, cry when you have to, be who you must. That's a part of the plan.
They learned that Fogelberg had lived and recorded in Nashville early in his career and had even written the song Part of the Plan in Nashville. Though they are entrenched in L.A., Karen Harris says all signs pointed to Nashville for the opening.
L.A. is a little more, oh, I could get in such trouble for saying this, but it's not as theater friendly. It's a film town. It's a studio town. It's a TV town. What Nashville gives us is real interest.
Nashville luminaries like Garth Brooks credit Fogelberg for influencing their style, and some of the city's recording executives, agents, and managers came out of the woodwork to support the production. But the most important pitch was to Kathleen O'Brien, which turned out to be the easiest of all.
They got me at Dan Fogelberg,
you know, I had to fight back tears.
The CEO of the Tennessee Performing Arts Center is such a fan of Fogelberg's, she has a clock made from a Fogelberg vinyl album on the wall in her office.
His music is just beautiful in terms of the composition of the notes, but his lyrics are just, where did he get this? It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. He was an old soul, for sure.
After a series of readings in Nashville last year, O'Brien was impressed with how the writers wove the story around well-known songs like Same Old Lang Syne.
I should have gone with you that night.
Don't say that now.
You're right. Well, here we are. A toast. The timing. And to you buying a wreath on my corner.
Drink a toast to innocence. Drink a toast to now. Try to reach beyond the emptiness, but neither one knew how.
I felt like the writers nailed the moment that song could have been written for that moment, but it wasn't. They were able to write a story and incorporate the right song at the right moment in this continuum, two-act play.
O'Brien wound up taking her enthusiasm one step further. The Arts Center injected more than $500,000 into the show and became co-producer.
It's a huge step. We're part of the team that makes decisions. We're part of the team that helps devise the budget. We're part of the team that weighs in on casting. That's very different, very, very different. And it's getting us much closer to the art.
The Performing Arts Center will profit if the show winds up touring or makes it to the Broadway stage. But for now, the producers are concentrating on the Nashville opening this month and welcoming self-described Dan fans to the theater to spend the night with those old Fogelberg ballads.
Life is bad for a tent. Limitating men. I'm just a living legacy to the leader of the band.
For Here and Now, I'm Amy Eskind.
Thank you for the music and the stories of the road. I thank you for the freedom when it came my time to go.
A note this afternoon about All Things Considered. There is a new study that emphasizes something researchers have noted for years, that children who speak Spanish take longer to learn English than nearly any other group. Researchers have some theories why this might be the case, and we'll hear about them this afternoon on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
And your song is in my soul. Just a little.